It's a therapeutic Thursday morning, 26 minutes after the hour, and time to welcome Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Robbie is an Anglican pastor, lives in Ashburn, Virginia, has a small, well-watered church there, as I recall. And he's also the executive director of Preserving Bible Time. How's the flood working out in your church there, Rob?
It's down to about your ankles.
Yeah, good to be with you and David. Yeah, we're still in exile.
Okay.
We're making do. You know, churches aren't buildings; they're groups of people. So,
well, water has been all around for all three of us the last game. David and his wife Carol were just down at the Ark in Kentucky, and they got 2 inches of rain, and there was a lightning strike on the Ark. All kinds of excitement there. Yeah. We had flooding up here, and had water in the house and stuff, and you had water in your church. So, 'tis the season, I think.
It's the season for a good flood.
Say we're all in the same boat. So to speak.
I'm trying not to take that lightning strike personally, but that happened on the day after I went. On the day that I was there.
What did you
do? We left about 5 o'clock, and then we got home back to the campground, and there was this big, heavy, very theatrical clouds over our campground. And then I heard this loud crack, and then I heard somebody snap his fingers and say, "Duh, so close."
That
was one of those Boris Karloff clouds, I think, was up there.
Boris Karloff.
Threatening.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Scary, yeah.
Yeah, very impressive. Okay. As long as I've hijacked the conversation.
Cue the clouds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the phrases I heard a lot at the Ark and at the museum was artistic license. And they've filled in the gap. Now, and in fact, I've got 3 books that I bought at the museum. It's the fictionalized account of Noah as a young man.
Oh, man.
I mean, boy, you got to stretch a long ways to put in details about that. I mean, the Bible doesn't even say the name of his wife.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the boys' wives. But I saw statues of them. Well, they're there. They're in the Ark.
What would they do with the whole drunken naked piece of Noah? Did they have any exhibits on that?
You know, I didn't see that. I think they had that display up, but then they decided to give the space to the Museum of the Bible.
I think that's in the bilge level of the Ark. You'll find that down there.
Yeah. It's a kid-friendly museum, so I imagine they were keeping it on the Ark.
Well, artistic license is a danger, and being so close to Preserving Bible Times, Robbie and I are both really sensitive to seeing that. I was watching The Chosen. And now I'm hooked. The first Carol was kind of lukewarm. Oh, yeah. Now she's really into it, too. They take artistic license, but it is faithful to the context of the time and the place and those people, as near as I can determine. And it's engaging that way. But if there's fantasy involved, and they have to make up dialogue, and these are actors speaking English, but all the cultural ramifications of first century Jewish life are there. And it validates the stories of the Bible because it is faithful to the context. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're here to learn today. And Robbie's been taking us through the book of Luke. And we're going to get a sampling of what his congregation is in store for on Sunday today in Luke 15.
But someday I would like to talk about the difference between the faithfulness to the to the first century Hebrews and the difference that Ken Ham does on the Ark and in the museum.
Yeah, it's interesting that for me, The Chosen does try to get to that root of context, but there's still some anachronism there.
I give them a long leash because it's clear they've tried to pay attention to context.
Right, but if you talk about in terms of like the Ark encounter and quote artistic license, I mean, you can draw a lot into the text that isn't there, and that can enter into the realm of danger. But we're all trying to read between the lines when we're looking at biblical context. We're looking through various lenses of culture, geography, and history the religious context, the agrarian society, all these little pieces, the more of these lenses we can put on, the more clearly we can see how the original authors intended the text and how the original readers would have read it. So at Preserving Bible Times, we do not ask what a text means to us until we first ask what it meant to its original hearers. And that's our thesis, that we can rightly understand and interpret the Bible from its original context, from when it was written, and then understand how the original hearers would have applied it, and then apply it to our lives. But we don't apply it to our lives. We don't ask the question, what does it mean to us, until we first ask what it meant to the original hearers.
And then it's valid because in Doug Greenwald's words, this was the original message is what was intended by the Holy Spirit in inspiring these writers, these authors, particularly of the Gospels, to recount their experience with Jesus. And so hearing it as they would have heard it, and for example, there's a parable in Luke 15 that I presume we're going to get to, the prodigal sons.
Yeah, three of them.
Well, there's three parables in a row. That alone
three parables is just two sons.
That's true.
Yeah, two sons, right?
But that alone is context right there.
Right.
And for example, I don't want to jump the gun here, Robbie, but the opening of the parable of the prodigal sons, Jesus mm-hmm. continued, there was a man who had two sons. Okay, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 words. At that point, and this is part of Doug's teaching too, his listening audience would have known that this was a story about birthright.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Instantly.
And that's loaded. If there are two sons, one's a younger, one's the older son.
Mm-hmm. So the original audience would have clued into that instantly, and it would set up the whole parable, which means it would emphasize certain points that Jesus had to make that we may miss entirely, or at least don't understand the intensity of the message. So context is extremely valuable. What's the context of Luke 15? Now, in Luke 14, there was the banquet with the Pharisees, and there were discussions on how you have to hate your mother and father to be a disciple. And then it goes on to a large crowd. Jesus is traveling with a large crowd. At the end of Luke 14, at the beginning of Luke 15, it says, now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. So I'm envisioning a large group of people, and Jesus must stop. I mean, they're moving. They can't believe they're just all static. But he would stop and maybe stand to the side of the road, or maybe they were in front of him on a mountainside. I'm not sure what the actual setting was here. But it was time to listen to him, and the Pharisees and the tax collectors crowded close to hear what he had to say. They were scoping him out, were they not?
Sure. So we still have our original audience from 14, which are the Pharisees and the religious leaders. Here we have the Pharisees and the scribes, who are mixed in with this crowd. So it's a mixed crowd that's following Jesus. So you have the tax collectors and the sinners. And at this point, you know, what's the difference? I mean, when you talk about tax collector and sinner to the Jewish listener, they would not really, you know, tax collectors, a whole nother level of sinner.
Mm-hmm.
They're both categories of people are sinners, the tax collectors and the sinners. The problem with the Pharisees and the scribes is they don't see themselves as part of this crowd. They see themselves as outside of this crowd or above this crowd.
And speaking of this crowd, it says in 14, large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and turning to them, he said, and that's when he talks about the bearing your cross and so forth. So
right. 14,
that suggests to me that this was in Galilee, where he spent most of his time, and he would be moving with this crowd. And I'm trying to analyze his teaching method here.
Yeah.
Because it was often do and teach. He would do something and then teach his own disciples what had just happened and why. What do you suppose is the setting here for Luke 15?
So a rabbi is going to teach as long as he has an audience. And that's pretty impressive. I mean, we're used to our 20 to 45 minute sermon, depending on what denomination you're part of. And the first century rabbi is going to teach as long as he has people listening. And Jesus is teaching this large crowd. You just quoted Luke 14:25 about the great crowds that are accompanying him. So, yes, this is on the move or on the fly where Jesus is teaching as he's going. And we just heard this banquet speech at a banquet in 14. So we've got a dinner happening, a banquet happening in 14. But now he's on the move. Chapter 15 of Luke begins with, "Now the tax collectors and sinners were drawing near to him." So this is an interesting, again, why say tax collectors and sinners? And that first verse should immediately, we should ask questions of the text. We should always question the text. And I don't mean question the validity of the text. I mean question the content. Question what it is. What is it that I just read? Well, right now in verse 1, we have two categories of people, tax collectors and sinners. The implication is not that the tax collectors are not sinners. The implication is they are worse sinners. The Jewish people believe that tax collectors were the lowest of the low because they're collecting taxes for Rome, and Rome is the enemy.
Well, they were largely Hebrews who had gone over to the other side, in their view, become traitors, working for the Romans.
And again, you have the Pharisees and the scribes here in this crowd, too. So they are seeing these two categories of people differently than, say, the tax collectors might look at the general sinners and think that they're in a better situation. At least they're not stigmatized by being a tax collector collecting taxes for Rome. And then, of course, the Pharisees and the scribes are thinking, well, we're not even in this category of tax collectors and sinners. We're religious leaders. We're above this crowd. And that's exactly the context of the next three parables, which, by the way, ends with the prodigal sons, plural. Mm-hmm. There's two of them. One is the prodigal that runs away, and the other is the prodigal that stays. And the prodigal that stays wants his father's resources rather than the father, just like the younger brother who wants his father's resources instead of the father and asks for his early inheritance. And you see this by the older brother's response, who says, "You've never even given me a goat to celebrate with my friends, and this son of yours, not this brother of mine, but this son of yours, has squandered your resources and thereby my resources." Because remember, the brother is he's having his resources taken by the younger brother once he comes back. Now his inheritance is yet divided again. And so we see the older brother pouting. He doesn't want to go into the feast to celebrate. And that's interesting because he is the Jewish figure. He is the scribe, the Pharisee figure that thinks that he has done no wrong, when in actuality, he is just as wrong as his younger brother.
He had an obligation here, too, before any of this runaway stuff and squandering of resources happened. He had an obligation to resolve differences as the older son, right?
Yes. So he should have been out looking for younger brother.
Mm-hmm.
But before Jesus even gets there to the parable of the prodigal sons, and I love how Tim Keller calls this the parable of the prodigal God. He calls it prodigal God because you've got three prodigals. Because the father's not acting like he should either. He's girding up his loins. He's running after his lost son who returns.
Demeaning himself thereby.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So there's tons of context. So let's, you know, we've got the beginning. The scribes and the Pharisees do not think they're part of the crowd here, the tax collectors and the sinners. They don't think that they're a part of these categories. And then, of course, the end is the older brother, and we don't know if he goes into the feast or not. There's your bookends. There's the beginning of chapter 15 and the end of chapter 15. And now we can make sense of everything in between. Because when we see how Jesus is beginning to tell these three parables and how he ends the very last one, you kind of see with what his point is. Stephen Covey said this. He said, "Begin with the end in mind." And so if you go and see how it ends, now we can see how we got there. And so looking at the verse 1, we see that we see the Pharisees and the scribes grumbling. We see what their problem is. This man is eating. He's receiving tax collectors and sinners, and he's eating with them. That is the presenting problem of the religious leaders that begins the three parables in verse 3. So the first two verses of chapter 15 set up the entire chapter of Luke 15. And so if you miss the literary context, because now we're talking about literary context, and the literary context is the first two verses are actual happening, what's going on. And then the rest of the verses are three parables. So we need to understand why Jesus is telling the parables, and we get that from the first two verses.
And it's logical to think that these three parables being presented in this order have something in common.
Yes.
We have some part of the message is in common with the others.
The lost and the found. Mm. I mean, this is the theme. I just found a red sweater cleaning out our flooded chapel space. And I thought to myself, I don't know whose sweater this is. Where is the lost and found? The lost and found is the place where you put all the lost stuff so you know where to find it. Mm-hmm. The problem with these three parables is there is no lost and found. We have lost things. We have a lost sheep, 1 of 100. Now watch this progression. I don't know if you've ever caught this. You've got 1 in 100, and then you've got a lost coin, which is 1 in 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have two brothers, and one is a prodigal that runs away. So there you have 50%, or as we find out later, that both sons are prodigal, and you've got 100% loss, but then the one comes back. And so again, you're stuck with 50% loss here. So you've got incremental increases in loss. So Jesus tells the parable of the lost sheep. Well, hold the press. I mean, right now, if you're questioning the text, what do you know about sheep? And do sheep get lost? And where would you leave 99 sheep to go look for a lost one? And is that something the shepherd should do? You're going to disregard the 99? And go find one? Well, if you know where they are, if they are in a sheep pen, if you're leaving them safe and then going, but this is 1/100th of your wealth in this case. And then, of course, the woman who's sweeping her home looking for a silver coin. Now, again, what kind of coin is this? How much of this loss is there? Well, we know it's 10% of whatever it is. If we look at the silver coins,
and there's a reason he says she has 10 and loses one. The numbers mean something here.
Sure. So here we most likely have a silver drachma coin, and these coins represent a day's wage. So in Luke 15, 8 through 9, we see that the drachma, each of which is worth one day's wages. So this woman has 10 days wages worth of revenue. She has funds. In her savings, she has 10 days. So when she loses a coin, she loses an entire day's wage.
There will be hunger on the 10th day.
Oh, yeah. What do you do? What do you do if you've lost a coin? And again, what kind of house is this? I mean, these are context questions. Like, why is it that she has to light a lamp? Why is it that it's dark in the house? Well, we know from excavations of first century homes, and David mentioned Museum of the Bible. We have a recreation of a first century home in the Museum of the Bible. We found the archaeological ruins of these homes. We know that if these homes have windows at all, they're high up in the walls. And the reason they're high up in the walls is because animals are brought into the home. And you do not want your animals or your children escaping the home through a low window, so you put your windows up high. The other thing is you want to keep thieves out of your home so you keep the window up high. So the light, if you have a window at all in your home, the light is minimal. And if you lose a coin, most likely it fell on the floor.
Weren't these homes also built of that dark basalt rock in areas of Galilee in particular? So it was like a black inside.
That's correct, mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's the limestone, which is white in color, and then the basalt stone, which is volcanic, which is dark in color. And certainly in Capernaum, all of the homes and even the millstones, Capernaum was known for the creation, the development of millstones, because they had this harder basalt stone. Basalt was a harder stone than limestone, which is more of a softer stone. So if you're going to make millstones, the best place to do it is Capernaum because of this basalt stone. And it's harder to chisel, but then again, when you're grinding with it, it grinds what you're grinding and not the stone itself, like limestone would. So when Jesus says something like, don't cause one of these little children to stumble, is better than a millstone be tied around their neck than cast in the deepest of the seas, well, you've got the Sea of Galilee, and of course you've got Capernaum, which is a manufacturer of millstones. So you've got both of these objects that you can point to while you're teaching, and Jesus often did this. But yes, these first century homes, particularly in the evangelical triangle where Jesus spent 80% of his time in ministry and life in the region of Galilee, were made out of this basalt stone. So yes, this woman needs to light a lamp. She needs to take a broom and to sweep out her home. This is an earthen floor, so it's dirty, and the dirt can be loose, so that coin can get caught up inside of the dirt that you're sweeping off the hardened earthen floor. So you're going to have to sift through that and really meticulously look through it. Now, how long would that take a 16-foot by 14-foot or 15 by 15 home? Would it take a day? Would it take a couple of hours? Well, even if it took you a half a day, you're looking for a coin that is worth a day's wages. Is it worth it to you to stop everything and to look for this lost item? And the answer is yes. This coin is of great value to you if you are a woman who has lost 10% of her wealth.
So the numbers are important. The geographical and cultural and historical context are all part and parcel of these stories. But there's another element that strikes me as being present in each of the three parables, and that is each one ends with a community celebration.
Yes, there's a celebration because my sheep that was lost has now been found. Come and celebrate with me. Rejoice with me. So you've heard Jesus' own words. He says, weep with those who weep, rejoice with those who rejoice. So we are to be celebrating a success in the village. So in other words, when one person in the village, and again, this is now the communal life. What is life like?
Yeah, the rugged individual was not part of the culture there.
Right. And so when we read this as Westerners, we're like, what's with all the partying? You know, get over it. I mean, if you found your coin, be happy about it. But no. Rejoice with me. This is a communal view that is very Hebrew. And we in our Western thinking, we don't think like this. And so all through these parables, there is context which illuminates the meaning. Now, in the case of the prodigal sons, the celebration, and we get this context actually with the animals that are being talked about. Remember, the older brother says, you didn't even give me a lamb to celebrate with my friends. Well, there's some context for you.
Mm-hmm.
A lamb will feed you and your friends. So if you slaughter a lamb, you've got enough for a small party with you and your friends. If you slaughter the fattened calf, which is what the father does for the prodigal who returns, he says, this son of mine who was lost is now found. Bring out the best robe, which is the father's robe. Bring out the ring, put my ring upon his finger, which is the father's signet ring is placed upon the younger brother's finger, which again, that's a birthright thing. That's a authority piece. So this father is so happy that he gives his youngest son the best of the best. And this is part of what makes the older brother angry, because this is part of his inheritance. These are things that are part of what he should be receiving. Now, you should already be in your mind playing what the Hebrew people already know about, which is Joseph and his brothers. You know, the Joseph of the Technicolor Dreamcoat mm-hmm. fame? Well, why is it that Joseph is despised and hated? It's because he's the eldest son of Rachel, but he's not the eldest son of Jacob. So when Joseph... when
he, too, was the youngest
yes. son. Well, no. He's the oldest of Rachel.
Ah.
Joseph is.
Mm-hmm.
So when Jacob treats him like the eldest, he should be favoring Leah's oldest, not Rachel's.
Hmm.
Because Leah's oldest son has the birthright. So why do they want to kill little brother? Because he is functioning as not the eldest, but he is giving the esteem of the eldest
son. You see the reason for their resentment there.
Yes. Hmm. So that's why dad gives him the coat of many colors. It's actually the birthright.
Mm-hmm.
Now go back. So what we're doing is we've got a replaying of the Joseph story playing out in the parable of the prodigal sons. And the Pharisees and the scribes are the elder brother who believe that they have the birthright. The younger brother is not my brother, according to the older brother, which is why he has disowned his younger brother, which is why he doesn't go and look for him. But yet when he returns, the father gives him basically the birthright, the signet ring, the best robe. And what are we slaughtering? The fatted calf.
Mm.
Now, why are we slaughtering the fatted calf at this point? Because the younger son has disgraced himself and the father before the entire village. So again, this is communal.
Well, in asking for his share of the estate, he was in essence saying, Dad, you're as good as dead to me.
That's right. So this son needs to be restored to the entire community, not only to his father and to his older brother, but he needs to be restored to the entire village, which is why the father slaughters the fatted calf. Now, how many people will the fatted calf feed? The entire village.
Hmm.
So here we see the reconciliation of the father with the younger son, with the entire village. And now we see that which is lost is now found.
And Jesus, it's about said, community. Now, in the old days, they would get together and have a party. Now we go and post on Facebook. You know,
that's right.
Artificial communities instead. Oh, my, how times have changed. Well, that does it for our time with Pastor Robbie this morning. We learned a lot, and we'll learn some more next week. Robbie, hope you'll be available next Thursday.
Indeed. Indeed. Jesus came to seek and save that which is lost, and that which is lost can be found.
Mm. PreservingBibleTimes.org. There's a website you need to know about there, and you can link to it from BrokenRoadRadio.com if you're listening there, or you just visit our website, or just put in PreservingBibleTimes.org. You'll find a whole bunch of stuff. Books and streaming video that will provide you with the context you need to see what's between the lines as you study the scripture, and particularly those four gospels. So,
if you guys will look at the chat window real quick, and I see it on my screen.
Okay,
and that's the stormy clouds that was over the campground.
Oh,
the day after we got back from the ark.
Okay.
And that's when the lightning strike was.
Okay. That's probably.
And that's when I heard somebody snap his fingers and said, "Oh, so close."
Yeah. Missed it by that much.
By that much. Go.
Robbie, thanks very much. We really appreciate you and your time. I know you're a busy, busy guy. You've got so many irons in the fire, so to speak. So, again, thank you so much. Have a terrific week. We'll see you in seven days hence, okay?
Godspeed, my friend. Thanks for having me on. Pleasure to be with you, Jim and David.
Bye-bye.
Good to see you, Robbie.